An evening of lively, smart conversation and jazz. Join me, John Williams, for a live taping of the Mincing Rascals podcast, Robert's Pizza, and Jazz, Wednesday, June 12th, 6 to 8 at Winter's Jazz Club in Streeterville. Tickets at WGNRadio.com/rascals. Today is Wednesday. It's March 20th, 2024, and it's 2:42 in the afternoon. Hi, and welcome once again to the Mincing Rascals podcast. This is John Williams. You can listen for me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
Hey, guys. Brandon Pope here, host of On the Block, powered by Block Club Chicago on WCIU and the Making Podcast from WBEZ.
I'm Austin Burt from the Illinois Policy Institute, and you can read my book, The New Chicago Way, Lessons from Other Big Cities.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter columnist, and now writing the Chicago history website, Roseland Chicago 1972.
I'm Eric Zorn. The Associated Press has declared me to be the publisher of the Picayune Sentinel.
Yeah, but there's still some votes to be counted, Eric. Maybe
still,
they will determine.
Still some write-in votes that might cost me my seat. It's true.
Okay, so it's 2:42 in the afternoon on Wednesday, and maybe some of these things that we're about to talk about may change depending on the last counted votes. But let's start here. What do you know? The Chicago Teachers Union isn't the boss of everybody after all. The union is, as we've discussed many times on this podcast, the leading political force in this town. And they made a concerted effort to give Mayor Brandon Johnson a victory on his Bring Chicago Home referendum. That ballot item seems to be failing today as the votes are still being counted. It would have raised the title transfer tax on properties over $1 million, and especially so on those over $1 million. The expected $100 million in revenue would have gone to, as yet unidentified, programs to help the homeless and poor. Chicagoans have demonstrated in the past a taste for taxing the quote-unquote rich to help the rest, but this time we are saying no. No, it seems, to Mayor Brandon Johnson's leadership. Kate, is that what it was? This was a sock in Brandon Johnson's eye?
Well, it's not good, that's for sure. I know it's not easy to get a referendum passed in the city. It's been 80 years or something since the last one. Quite a long time, so it's not an easy thing to do. But we have talked a lot about the fact that it was scheduled on purpose for this primary since it would have a low turnout, and that works well for the party in power, being the Democratic Party and CTU. They did not get it done. I thought it was interesting that the coverage today talked about how much more money the opponents had gotten together for their advertising campaign against it, about $2 million or a little bit over. But early on, if you recall, there was a lot of talk about how CTU and the Homeless Coalition had the advantage because they had a real army of people going door to door already. It's interesting that even with that, the advertising campaign was able to overcome it.
It's fascinating. It's sad to see. I know for housing advocates out there, this can be a defeating moment where you hear folks say they want to help the homeless, but not at the expense of my $1 million property. Natalie Moore, she probably said it best. She said Chicagoans say that they want to help the homeless first instead of migrants, but then defeat Bring Chicago Home, which would help fight homelessness. This was not a great rollout for this. Brandon Johnson's administration did not do a great job with executing the campaign itself. The fact that the majority of Chicago's home buyers would receive a tax cut, I think that should have been boosted more by the campaign itself. Instead, you had lots of other messaging that was clouding that out. The language of the referendum itself also confusing. Had a lot of people I talked to coming out of the poll. They're just like, I had to reread that thing several times to understand exactly what I was looking at. And there's also a general mistrust of government. The revenue from this is legally required to go towards homelessness. It would be. That wasn't communicated well enough. It was also hampered by the back and forth in the courts as well. The back and forth with, is it going to be on the ballot? Isn't it? Will the votes count? Will they not? Confused voters. Even I was confused after a while. Are they going to count or not? We had to answer that question so many times. I do think, though, that some of the attacks and complaints against the referendum itself, a bit disingenuous. a lot of talk about what's the plan, what are they going to do with the money. It was pretty well spelled out what the money was going to go toward.
I would disagree slightly with that. I think we know where the money was going to go, but we had no idea how it was going to be spent.
Totally disagree. They spelled it out explicitly on the bringchicagohome.org website where that money is going to go. The problem is they didn't message it well enough. They talked about going toward affordable housing voucher. They talked about going toward mental health services, substance use counseling, educational opportunities, job training. Like, they spelled it out pretty well where the money's going to go, more so than a lot of tax increases do. When you look at a thing like a gas tax, it says, oh, it's going to roads and bridges. It doesn't mention it's also going toward paying construction workers.
Well, then how do you explain that it failed?
I just explained how it failed. There was numerous reasons why it failed itself, including voters' mistrust of it overall and confusion about this narrative of what's the plan, when the plan is pretty well spelled out there.
Yeah.
Where it was the way to go.
Okay.
I can't accept that there's no plan. When it comes to progressive ideas, that's the only time this happens. Every other idea out there, we're going to raise taxes, is going to go toward this. Okay, makes sense. It was literally said very clearly. I just think the messaging itself on explaining to people, okay, it's not just a pot of money.
No, I get you. I was one of those people who did not know all the details on the plan and credited the failure of it to that. That was the failure of the administration, that they didn't have a plan. Maybe the failure of the administration is then they didn't tell me well enough. Like, I didn't click through.
It was 71.4% of Chicago voters approved the graduated income tax referendum back in, was it 2020? 2020. And so I was under the impression that the city voters were really amenable to essentially what was sold as a soak the rich tax. Whether it actually was or not, I don't, there's, I mean, I know Austin is going to weigh in a moment and give his own spin on this. But when you look at it that way, though, when you look at the fact that nearly three out of every four Chicagoans voted for the fair tax, the graduated income tax, and then have apparently rejected a sort of similar proposal here, I think really speaks to a vote of no confidence in Mayor Johnson and a vote of a distrust of the CTU. I think there's a real political message behind this rejection that people are, and I certainly talked to a lot of people who felt like this was kind of a little bit of a referendum on Johnson's leadership.
Oh, of course it was.
If there had been a different mayor, and they could have maybe sold this a little bit differently, I'd agree that the messaging was not great on their part. And some of this attempts to paint every thing that sells for over $1 million as a mansions tax is, or they're just going to get the rich. There are a lot of small businesses and three flat owners and so on who are very concerned about the amount of money that was going to add to their tax bill. I don't think it would have been all that much actually on most properties. Even a house that sells for $1.5 million, it's going to add a little bit to the mortgage over a long period of time, a one-time payment. I don't know. It didn't seem like it was going to be all that much for most people, but it was. It somehow failed for that. But I think the only way to look at this is really a repudiation of Mayor Johnson and his leadership.
I agree. On its face, this was a tax on mansions to fund homelessness in an essentially entirely Democratic primary in the city of Chicago, and it lost. So it's a stunning rebuke of Johnson. It's a stunning rebuke of the Chicago Teachers Union's political machine. They had every single structural advantage to win this. That includes CTU knocking on 300,000 doors, making 600,000 phone calls. This was log rolled with the tax cut for a vast majority of property transactions. The lawsuit to remove it, I think, very much advantaged the yes side, actually, because it scared money away from the no side, because people thought, well, this is not on the ballot. So they were not putting money into the campaign for a very critical 2-week period. Record low turnout, 20% turnout, which advantages people who can get out the vote. And as Eric said, Chicago voted 71% yes on Pritzker's referendum. So people did not trust that there was a plan with this. And while Brandon's correct, Bring Chicago Home detailed a lot of things they would like to do with the money. But that's not a law. That's not in writing. For a thing like a gas tax, there's a 100 bajillion page capital bill detailing where all that money is going. This is just an advocacy group saying where we'd like to spend the money. And at the same time, you have another advocacy group, the Chicago Teachers Union, in their contract demand saying, hey, first we're going to pass Bring Chicago Home, and then we're going to get like money for housing for our members. And when people see that, they're like, well, this is like not, that none of this is guaranteed. When we don't have a plan in writing in Chicago and there are promises made, those are usually not kept. Whether you look at parking meter sale, whether you look at the lottery, whether you look at the Skyway, like those things are not kept. This is a sea change in Chicago. And really, there was a knock-on effect with this question for the state's attorney's race. And I think it was Craig Wall in ABC7's coverage last night who was reporting on this. And he basically said, well, Clayton Harris in the state's attorney's race was relying on Bring Chicago Home to bring out progressive votes. That was not a good strategy. And he is now losing by around 10,000 votes to Eileen O'Neill Burke. I think she will maintain that lead. I also think Bring Chicago Home, there is no mathematical way that that can win, even with outstanding mail ballots. So it's defeated. And Bring Chicago Home blamed Illinois Policy Institute for its defeat, which is very flattering. But the real work now is to actually bring people together to fight for solutions that are proven that can actually help solve poverty in the city of Chicago. And there are many solutions that are not divisive that can do that. You should be eliminating barriers to work. It's way too hard to find work in the city because of occupational licensing rules. You should make it way easier to build affordable housing from developers. You should make our educational system much, much, much better and put more money into the classroom, less money into administration, less money into the CTU, and more choice for students. There are so many other solutions that we could be pursuing to bring people together to fight poverty in Chicago, and this was not it.
I'm playing back in my head the commercial, though, that the only commercial I saw about this on TV had Brandon Johnson's face on it, and essentially was saying, vote no on Brandon Johnson. That was the message that I saw over and again, Austin. You know the spot I'm talking about?
Yes.
Was that you guys that funded that commercial?
That was not us funding that. So it was another group spending money on sort of the air war. We worked with that group. But to Kate's point, the spending on traditional media was about the same on both sides. The Chicago Teachers Union committed $700,000 to this, I believe, between $400,000 and $700,000. The numbers are still coming in on that. So I think it was around $2 million when it's all said and done was spent by both sides.
Yeah.
And it ultimately came down to, do people trust the current governance of the city? Overwhelmingly, Democrats who do not. And what you see, what's really interesting, if you look at the precinct level data, is the massive drop off, especially in black, majority black precincts, between votes for Brandon Johnson and votes for Bring Chicago Home. So there's a steep, steep drop off there. Precincts that were voting 70, 80, 90% for Brandon Johnson versus Paul Vallis were only voting 40, 50, 60% for Bring Chicago Home.
Do you think Republicans pulled the Democrat ballot to vote? Well, actually, they could have voted for this on either side. But I think if they wanted to have a deciding vote on, say, the state's attorney's race, Republicans were pulling Democrat ballots. Do you think that skewed the results in any way?
I'm sure other people on the panel maybe heard anecdotally of that happening. I think many people did do that. I don't know the extent to which that was done. Turnout was so low anyway. It's sort of like, oh, man, this is, you know, very marginal at best. But no, I think absolutely Republicans pulled ballots in the state's Democratic primary.
This is John Catanzara, the FOP leader, urged his Republican-leaning members to take Democratic ballots to vote for Eileen O'Neill Burke. And you're right, with the low turnout, that number might not have been very large, but could it have been 10,000? That's not a lot, because I don't think there was anything interesting at all on the Republican side, unless you wanted to cast a symbolic vote for Nikki Haley or something. Why would you have pulled a Republican ballot in Chicago? That was really, really nothing to vote for.
Not to go off on that tangent, but think about that. The people who pulled the Republican ballot in Chicago, 20% of them, 19-point-something% of them, did not vote for Donald Trump at the top of the ticket. They were still voting for Ron DeSantis and Nikki Haley. Joe Biden did not get 100% of the people to pull the Democrat ballot either. That may be one of the ways to gauge the crossover there. I think he got 91%. Yeah, it was 9.1 or something like that. But I had another question for Austin, and that is, you tweeted, this is a great day for Chicago. This was never about fighting homelessness. I'd like you to explain that. I think that it was a failed maybe rollout, like Brandon said, but How was it not about fighting homelessness? What was it about if it wasn't that?
What I mean when I say that is that the idea that we can simply dump more money into vaguely combating homelessness, which was the real only real guardrail in this referendum, in the actual ballot language, it just said the money has to be used to, quote, combat homelessness. That is extraordinarily broad and ill-defined and would be pushed and pulled in every which direction to justify money being used for pet projects. But in the city of Chicago, the city has tripled its spending on homelessness over the last decade. And the number of people that the city reports to be experiencing homelessness, which is around 6,100 people, has remained the same. And in fact, if you even look to the beginning of the war on poverty, decades and decades ago, the poverty rate in Chicago has not changed. This approach doesn't work. And this approach, I don't think, is really about reducing homelessness. And I'm simply saying that based on the results.
But that's
what I mean.
What do you think it was about then? Did they just want more money? I mean, why go down this road if they didn't want to, in fact, apply the funds the way they said they were going to?
I don't doubt that proponents maybe think what they are doing is going to help combat homelessness. What I'm saying is that the evidence of this approach is failed, and it's failed in Chicago, and it's failed in other cities that have tried this. L.A. infamously started a mansion tax that's caused all sorts of mayhem in the real estate sector. And that is not making any meaningful steps towards the reduction of homelessness. It is a political and ideological fight more than it is a practical one of effective provision of social services. And I don't think that's what this was about at all.
Homeless policy is definitely complicated in terms of people proving what's working and not working. I'm sure that's part of why they never did, at least on an official basis, want to commit to exactly what they were going to do with that money. Because I do have to agree that the Bring Back Chicago Coalition's website, while it did have kind of a wish list of what it wanted to do with that money, that just was not official. And the longer this campaign went on, the more people understood and the more it was publicized that there was nothing official about how
but
that
it couldn't
be,
Kate, but it couldn't be either. I mean, it's like,
well,
you guys said,
they could have passed
an ordinance before this referendum saying in the event that a referendum passes, the money will be used for these line items.
Well, that's on the city council, but that's on the city council then, right, Austin?
That's what I'm saying. I don't think it was a miscommunication by the backers of the referendum. I think that's just that people understood more and more that there was no absolute constraint on how the money was exactly going to be spent. I was really struck by, I think it was the Sun-Times account of talking to people coming out of the polls. Yes, anecdotal, but there was one guy in a, you know, North Side liberal neighborhood who had particularly not voted for President Biden in order to write in Gaza. So you know he's progressive. He's probably a Brandon Johnson guy, but he voted against Bring Chicago Home. And he specifically said because he wanted to help with homelessness, but he did not trust the city with a big pot of money without knowing exactly what was going to happen with it. Uh-huh. When you lose somebody like that over that practicality, that's real. That's not messaging. That's real.
That's a good point.
I hear you. I definitely hear you on that. And I think that's I think the messaging is a big part of that because I'm looking at the referendum question now to be used for the purpose of addressing homelessness, including providing permanent affordable housing and the services necessary to obtain and maintain permanent housing in the city of Chicago. So if we're worried about misuse for pet projects, I don't think you're given a lot of wiggle room there to go far outside the bounds of homelessness.
Well, that does not actually, you know, tie anyone's hands whatsoever. That's just on the coalition's website.
That's that wasn't the
ballot.
It's not a requirement in any way.
Yeah. That's the actual language on the ballot. That's right, Brandon. But it's to be used for the purpose of addressing homelessness, including Yeah, providing permanent affordable housing and the services necessary to obtain and maintain permanent housing.
They're legally bound by the courts to use it for homelessness. I'm confused why people keep saying what's the plan when there's numerous taxes out there that raise revenue for a certain purpose, but there's no long fleshed out plan of exact policy where that money is going to go. A tale as old as time in politics, but all of a sudden now it's, well, where's the money going? It's been explained. Okay, but where's it going? It's been explained. They didn't communicate this well enough. And they allowed the question of what's the plan permeate people when really pretty fleshed out. Especially if you go into the website.
Well, I think that's an interesting point, Brandon, because if you think of how we use the pandemic relief money, right? Like everybody's suffering, and so we got pandemic relief money. And that went to everything. We still have pandemic relief money 4 years later.
Great example of why there should be a plan when you're giving people blank checks to spend.
That's definitely foremost in people's minds about why it's a bad idea.
Let me finish the point, though.
Like a fire hose.
Brandon, I don't need to speak for you, but what I'm hearing Brandon say is that if, in fact, we are used to, if we have always been comfortable with that kind of funding, the one time then it comes to, all right, Len, let's at least help the poor and the homeless, and they say, oh, no, I got to see a plan. You guys picked a funny time to draw a line in the sand about that.
I'll also add, with the COVID money, it was not legally bound to be spent for COVID. This is legally bound by the courts to be used for homelessness. That's why I'm just like, this messaging that, oh, but what? It's just this pot of money they can use for anything. That's not true.
There is a big, vast array of what homeless policies there are. And it is it is such a complicated issue that I wouldn't even want to get into debating what works and what doesn't work without spending about a week studying up on the issue. But there's also, if it's not possible to expand that language to include quite a lot of things, then why was the CTU talking about using it for housing for new teachers? That's not homeless people.
Yeah, in the Chicago Teachers Union's line item demands, there's things like green community affordable housing for teachers, students, and community members, which you could file that under addressing homelessness, because the CTU's leading message and what they were talking to media about all the time was there are many students experiencing homelessness, broadly defined. So I wouldn't trust the city to say no to that deal, given the current power arrangement. And at the same time, I don't think most people, when they're saying, I'm signing off on $100 million to combat homelessness, I think they're thinking of things like shelters for people who are experiencing homelessness, mm-hmm, or mm-hmm. mental health services, mm-hmm. or opening up clinics, things like that. Not like a Green New Deal for the Chicago Teachers Union. Those are categorically different things, but will both be allowed under this. It is narrower than, Brandon, you're correct in saying, it's not like it can be used to build a new stage for Lollapalooza, right? Like, that's clearly not allowed. But there is a broad definition of what they could constitute as addressing homelessness, I think.
You're putting trust in the administration to be able to execute that. So ultimately, absolutely, that was a big part of it as well. And ultimately, that's a tough sell for politicians.
And ultimately, do you think that's the way this vote went? Like, I hear Austin coming up with what sound like pretty good ideas. If you're going to use the money, advocate for that, or don't raise the money and do this. But it sounds like Austin has better ideas to fight homelessness than maybe this quote unquote blank check. But it wasn't so much about the program. It was about the trust. It was about, do you believe in and trust Brandon Johnson and his administration to do right by this money? That's what this was.
That could be the case. That could be one of many factors. But yes, I believe that is a factor that contributed. It's just ironic to me that, you know, realtors, landlords, mega developers, they're the major opposition to this. One could argue they're a major reason as well for the homeless crisis in this city. And they're spent all this money to oppose this, and they're going to raise rents next month. like we live in a hamster wheel at this point. I'm curious to hear what the plan is then.
But that ball's back in Brandon Johnson's court, isn't it? I mean, he said Bring Home Chicago is going to help the homeless, and maybe this was his funding mechanism. But do we all agree that he still has an obligation to do something about this? Are you aware of what Plan B is? I do have a statement from the mayor that producer Pete just handed me here. And this is actually a tweet from Alice Yin. Mayor Brandon Johnson on Bring Chicago Home's waning hopes, quote, This is the greatest city in the world. He's got to stop starting statements with that, but that's okay. He said, this is the greatest city in the world. I'll stop. This is the greatest city in the world. There is not a fight that we have taken on that we won't have the ability to win. The progressive agenda is expansive, as it should be. 40-plus years, decades of disinvestment. I'm going to be especially vulnerable here. You all know how the rules work on campaigning for referendums. My record of being able to compel and campaign and convince, there were some limitations. So guess what? Ooh. He said, buckle up. I'm not exactly sure what all that means. Anybody
buckle wonder? Up?
There's been murmurings that I've heard of them. If this were to fail, they're going to go for it again in November. I don't know if that's a smart course of action either. But he does make a point on this end. He couldn't be as front-facing. That could be a good thing for him or a bad thing.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't think it's proven that that would be good.
Don't be afraid.
Brandon Johnson's saying, like, let me at him. And there's a guy, like, pulling his collar in the back. And it's like, no, you're not good for this.
But I'm saying, like, okay, so we saw the vote, the black ward that voted for Brandon Johnson, we saw that they did not support this in as large of numbers, correct?
Right.
So if he could have actually stepped foot and done a lot more retail politics in some of these places, maybe that changes a bit. Because part of the reason why that drop happened is because in some of these black wards, there was messaging going around and pamphlets going around calling this a migrant tax. And there's already a lot of sentiment, anti-migrant sentiment in these black communities who feel like all the resources are going toward the migrant crisis and none for black people and black communities that have been struggling, especially with homelessness. So that targeted onslaught there, I think, was part of it. And him not being able to go into the churches and do his thing, he's a personable guy. He can work a room. That could have had a bit of an impact. I'm going to give him a little leeway on that part, but I also say with Austin, yeah, probably could have hurt you too.
Is he implying that there was some legal restraint on him campaigning? And is that true?
Yes. So he can't use public resources to campaign. So it'd be the same thing of, if he was sending out mailers for his own reelection using city resources, he can't use his position as the mayor, really. There are restrictions on that of him pushing people to vote one way or another on this. So that's true. And I think Brandon's point is good, that maybe some of the turnout in those black precincts could have been better if they associated it with Brandon Johnson, who they supported. I think that could be true. But ultimately, politicians don't like voting for things that go on the ballot that are not extremely popular. So getting city council to vote again after this just lost, that's a pretty decent margin. It's going to end up winning by like 6, 7, 8 points. And so to then ask those same politicians to say, oh no, we're going to do a lot better this time, definitely put it on the ballot, that's a huge ask. And that's the reason you don't see the fair tax referendum come up in Springfield anymore. Because afterwards, Pritzker and Harmon and Welch came out and they said, well, clear voters do not want this. We're not going to try for this again. And I think you're going to see the same thing in Chicago. If they are able to muscle this through somehow and get this into the November, I should add, the other point of this is $100 million is not a huge amount of money in terms of the city's budget. So you're also asking people to kind of put their neck on the line for what ultimately will not be a very large amount of money coming in. So that's one thing to consider. If they do put it on the ballot, I would expect the no side to be able to raise 10 times as much because they just proved that they could beat it. And I don't think the yes side is going to raise that much more than they already did. So I think that's a really, really hard sell to get this on the November ballot.
Well, and it was the received wisdom that it was smart for them to do it during this primary with a very low turnout and that the ground game would work. And we're looking at an election in the fall, which is going to have a pretty high turnout. I mean, one of the reasons for a low turnout yesterday, I thought, was that there was very, very little interesting on the ballot, except for the state's attorney's race, where I think you had to be kind of really politically tuned in to appreciate the difference between those two candidates. And then the Bring Chicago Home referendum, but there was no Senate primary, and the presidential primaries have already been decided. So there was, I think, not a lot of reason to get people out to vote, which is why you had such a terrible turnout yesterday.
I wonder how Stacey Davis Gates is feeling.
Melissa Conyers-Urban, they endorsed against Andy Davis. They were behind her, and she lost by about 30 points.
Yeah. Oh, that was a long shot.
That was a long shot, but definitely a loss. The mayor is now on notice because the next thing that's going to come up are contract negotiations with CTU, and people kind of just said, we're not standing for this kind of governance. It was not a right-wing vote that said that. So I think that will be top of mind.
Here's my Bring Chicago Home 2.0 when he goes for it again. He should be Jimmy Cartering the thing. There with a hammer and some people working on housing for the poor. Like literally, physically show me the results of money being spent to help the poor, or he's at a work site where people now have jobs or something, make it more tangible in a way. And also maybe instead of 1.5, because to be honest with you, I think that was one of the big pushes at our radio station. This guy named David Hochberg, who granted is in the mortgage business, and he didn't like the math on this thing at all, but maybe it's $10 million instead of $1.5 million, $5 million. Find a higher number for the threshold of this thing to kick in. Because I think a lot of people were showing me three flats going, wait a minute, I pay rent here. I'm not sure that the fact that this failed, though, is going to keep rents from going up. And if you had bought a property and you, say, paid a mortgage on the property, you would amortize those raised rents over 30 years. I don't think rents were going to go through the roof on people. And by the way, your rents may still go up because that's what rents do.
Look at cities that are cutting rent. So Austin, Texas, hottest real estate market in the planet over the COVID era. Tons of people every single day moving to Austin, Texas. Their rents are going down and landlords are freaking out because everybody paid a ton of money to go live in Austin, Texas. But guess what? They built tons and tons of housing because it's easy to build. So it actually led to a reduction in rents, which is an amazing achievement in that city. And we should make that easier here. Like we can lower rents in Chicago. It's not going to happen by increasing taxes and then giving the money to homelessness services. That is not going to affect rents. What's going to affect rents is letting people build, making it easier so that a developer doesn't have to go on bended knee to an alderman to say, please, mother, may I get three zoning variances on this? And I depend on at least your ambivalence for me to be able to give housing to people. That's how you fix rents.
We've heard that before. To your point, John, if we're going to do a Bring Chicago Home 2.0, I would urge the Johnson administration and the Bring Chicago Home campaign to be smarter about how they message it. Explain in vivid detail that this is more than just a tax increase, but also a tax decrease, while also taking advantage of the surrogates. That is the part that kind of really stood out to me. There weren't a lot of high-profile surrogates at all latching on to this. The most high-profile was probably Vic Mensa. But I was expecting to see some Chance the Rapper, some Common, some people that could really activate young voters, Black voters, Latino voters. And we didn't see a lot of that. So I would also encourage them to take advantage of that, because these landlords were in their bag. They were emailing tenants saying, hey, this is how you should vote. So you got to find some other ways.
Okay. Here's my other commercial. So then there's a mom pushing a grocery cart down the aisle at the grocery store, and she reaches for an item and then looks at the camera and says, thanks, Brandon Johnson. Because of the reduction in my title transfer, I now have more money to buy the bigger can of beans or whatever. And she puts it in and pushes on. Mayor Johnson's 2.0. I don't know. They should call me. Oh, here's.
I love the brainstorming happening here.
Austin is already writing the response to that ad for the Illinois Policy Institute website.
So. What I
he's just not dated by it at all.
My ad does not have to be connected to the facts on the ground. Having said all of that about that, what else did we miss? I mean, we've all agreed that there wasn't a lot on the ballot.
Well, I was surprised by the margin of victory that Danny Davis had in his district. I had predicted that he had four opponents, two of whom were thought to be fairly credible. And he won with more than 50% of the vote, which I thought was a real vote of confidence in the party, the power of the party to to drag him over the finish line. I didn't even require much dragging. I noticed that Mariana Spyropoulos, is that how you say her name? The new county court clerk. She will be the new county court clerk after she wins
with
in
Metropolis, Eric.
Okay. Spyropoulos, Metropolis.
Nice.
The Metropolitan Water Reclamation District. She clobbered Iris Martinez, the incumbent, and Supreme Court Justice Joy Cunningham just thumped First District Appellate Justice Jesse Reyes for the Illinois Supreme Court. Now, she is an incumbent, but only after the resignation of Justice Ann Burke.
This is her first election win.
First election, but she was endorsed by the party. So the party did very well in those things. The party failed to reelect State Senator Natalie Toro, which I thought was also kind of interesting because they put a ton of money. Anybody who watched any YouTube videos in the last couple of months saw these ads for Natalie Toro. They were unavoidable. And Senate President Don Harmon had put a ton of money into Natalie Toro's campaign. But Guzman, who was a CTU candidate, and I think the considered to be the more progressive candidate, won that race. So this was some interesting things. Every incumbent on the ballot in the congressional races won, I believe, in the state. So there were no upsets. People had spilled a lot of ink talking about a lot of those elections, but I didn't see any surprises there. So I think that one of the things is that this nearly even split in the city between Eileen O'Neill Burke and Clayton Harris III for the state's attorney's race reflects a divided Democratic Party between sort of the sort of moderate to even conservative Democrats in the city and then the highly progressive socialist Democrats. That there's a strong split, and it's a fairly even split.
Maybe I shouldn't be surprised. I thought that was going to be more one-sided. I thought that would be decided by now in her favor.
Now, why did you think that? Because I thought that Vallis was going to beat Brandon Johnson for the same kind of reason, that people were sort of upset about crime. They wanted this tough, experienced guy. Yeah, he's a little bit too conservative, but there's a real conservative streak in Chicago Democrats. But Johnson beat him. And so I had thought Harris was going to beat I predicted Burke was going to beat Harris, but I was suspecting that the same forces that elected Brandon Johnson were going to elect Harris and Kim Fox. They'd elected Kim Fox as well.
I think it came down to two numbers. I mean, I don't know what it came down to. I don't have an explanation for it. But she kept saying $300 and he kept saying $1,000.
The retail theft?
The retail theft amount. She said she's going to prosecute below $300 or starting at $300. And then he said, well, we can prosecute at any amount you want. She's picked a number lower than mine, but we can do whatever the hell we want. But he said, I'm going to follow the law and we're going to prosecute the people that need to be prosecuted. So he was saying he would be as tough on crime as her, but her number on retail theft prosecutions was advertised as lower for the threshold, and I think that resonated with people.
Her threshold was in line with state law, and Kim Fox had gone her own way on that and raised the threshold to 1,000. And I think you're right, John. I think that message was starting to resonate when people were seeing these sort of smash and grab shoplifting events that occur, and people, you know, got people run into stores and start filling up bags and running out, and it takes a while to get to $1,000, I guess, and so there's the fear of getting caught isn't that high, and that's troubling to people, I guess. I mean, that was one of the few differences that was really outlined between the two of them in terms of actual policy differences.
I talked to him a couple times. I liked him. I liked everything about his story, and I liked the way he answered the questions. But I'll be honest with you. The more he talked, the more he sounded like Brandon Johnson to me. And at one point, he even used the word progressive in our interview. And I says, I wouldn't use the word progressive if I were you.
Well, there was not a huge divergence between them on policy, except for that $300 versus $1,000. So that was definitely probably the dividing line, because if he was pretty specific in saying that he was going to be sticking with Kim Fox's policies, and she was constantly repeating, if you're happy with what's going on now, then don't vote for me. So if we're thinking that Bring Chicago Home is a referendum on Brandon Johnson, then are we thinking that this is a referendum on
Kim Fox?
Kim Fox's tenure and Tony Preckwinkle's control over the office too?
Could be. Could be. I would think so, ultimately, just because the two, just from interviewing them both, as you said, I don't think there are many differences. Eileen O'Neill Burke is actually here to talk about the Safety Act. She calls it a landmark piece of legislation. She's in lockstep with the Democratic Party. If you're a person that wanted Clayton Harris to win, I don't think you should be that upset.
And yet, Tony Preckwinkle was so upset about it, she wouldn't go to Manny's, right? She got up her own little party at Philo's instead. I thought that was kind of strange. I mean, because of the fact that Burke is not wildly divergent at all from the candidate Preckwinkle was backing, it seemed a little over the top to me.
To Eric's point about Brandon Johnson beating Paul Vallis, that is true. But we got to remember, it was a really narrow margin by which he beat Paul Vallis. And if you took his margin and applied that to when Kim Fox's last election was, if Kim Fox had only gotten a Brandon Johnson level margin in Chicago, she would not have won. So I think that was not an insignificant factor, actually, in Kim Fox choosing not to run and Preckwinkle choosing not to run Kim Fox, is that they saw a very narrow window for her to be able to win the countywide election if she was only going to be able to do numbers like Brandon Johnson in Chicago. So what we're seeing right now with the returns from Burke versus Harris is that Burke and Harris almost exactly split the city of Chicago, and then the suburbs are going for it, with Harris maybe probably his lead will grow a little more and more in Chicago, and then Harris more dominating the suburbs. So that's why I that was always her path to victory, is can she get a Vallis level win in Chicago and then pick up ground in the Cook County suburbs.
I also wonder if Kim Fox's decision to not endorse she didn't call this an endorsement, but officially say who she's voting for until a day or two before Election Day. I do wonder if that helped or hurt Clayton Harris. I think there's an argument for both. There's an argument that he made it a point to stay away from the Kim Fox stuff as much as possible for a reason. And there's an argument that there's some people that may have been more engaged in this election and this race in Chicago had Kim Fox put her foot on the scale, who are Kim Fox supporters. So it's political calculus, and I just wonder how it would have played out.
So if you were a candidate for state's attorney, what would you prefer, John Catanzara to not endorse you or Kim Fox to endorse you? Because neither of those may be good things. In the span of 87 days this summer, Grant Park will be booked for commercial events, 73 of them. Lollapalooza, NASCAR, Suenos, which is a music fest in late May. And that's streamlined compared to last year. Kate and I both noticed this. It was a Block Club Chicago story. Maybe you guys did too. But it's just going to be this sort of annual harangue we have on my radio station anymore. And some people saying this is a great use of the public resource. And some of us saying, I'm tired of looking at the fencing and the traffic diversions around our beautiful lake. We endure these winters so we can have Lakeshore Drive, Grant Park, Millennium Park. And then these things seem to be not at our disposal as much as they should be. Kate, where are you on that?
Oh, it just drives me crazy. It's mostly the NASCAR. If you could take out the NASCAR, then I probably wouldn't complain at all. It just is what it is. I mean, music festivals, especially the city free festivals, you know, Blues Fest, Jazz Fest, of course, everyone is free to come. Lollapalooza, I'm not so crazy about, but it was the one big thing, and it was only for a week. Now you add on NASCAR, and according to that article, NASCAR is bringing down its time period of setup and breakdown from 41 days all the way down to 29 days.
That's a month.
So you're looking at this hideous stuff. Anytime you're going to Grant Park, you're having to go around it to try and actually be in Grant Park. And if you are a Southsider like me who has to get to the North Side, you are just continually screwed, just continually by this going on in Grant Park.
Because you're coming up Lakeshore Drive, you mean?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. Last year, they had Lakeshore Drive shut down. I think it was two lanes of the northbound.
Hey, how do you feel about post-sex nachos?
What?
That's in one of the bands at Lollapalooza.
Oh, yeah, get your mind out of the gutter. Yes, I'm talking about the bands at Pawpaw.
They, you know, they actually do have a lot of relatively mainstream people. I really have no quarrel with Lollapalooza. I really feel like if you could take off NASCAR, I wouldn't care too much about Grant Park. But then, you know what, John? It was also partially lumping that onto some neighborhoods to really get inundated also with their own local private
fest. You're talking about like Riot Fest or something like that? Well,
yeah, Riot Fest was obviously really bad for that neighborhood. And Block Club had also had an article about Pilsen, Pilsen neighbors organizing against a fest. I forget the name of it. That's been held there. Now, that fest just moved to Oakwood Beach. They insisted it wasn't because the neighbors ran them out, that they just wanted to go. On the other hand, I also had to say to myself, public spaces, Oakwood Park, Oakwood Beach. I mean, yes, it's a public space, but that is such a popular community beach. It is just full of families barbecuing.
How far south is that? What's the east-west on there?
39th Street.
39th?
Yeah, basically 39th Street Beach. So when that gets a lot of festivals because it's a great area now.
Yeah.
And so if private festivals are going to be taking over Oakwood Beach, why is it okay for private festivals to be crowding out the community for whom that is the right beach to go to? Why is that okay?
See, Bertrand says to me whenever I talk about this, my colleague at the radio station, he does news and used to be a regular on this podcast. He says, okay, you're all upset because the Grant Park access is limited. When's the last time you tried to go to Grant Park? And then I go, he says, so what are you really complaining about here? Is it the view when you go up Lakeshore Drive? I think that's a legitimate complaint, by the way. One way to enjoy Grant Park or Millennium Park or the lake is to drive by it and look at it out your window. And now I look at 8-foot-tall fences. So So I think that's a fair complaint.
Could you tell Steve to ask me that question? Because my answer would be all the time, Steve.
Oh, yeah, you get up there a lot. Oh, I will call you the next time that comes up.
I love the passion. But I agree, NASCAR ruins a lot. I've come out as pretty anti-NASCAR headaches. I'm not really anti-NASCAR, but the headaches that come with it. But hey, if it can be a cool event, I think they did a great job showing their community focused. I love some of the activations they did on the south side of Chicago and the west side with Bubba Wallace. So they did the PR game right. They got me on the public relations.
They got you up, huh, Brandon?
not yet. No. I never got no free tickets. I wish. We'll see how it goes.
How about this, you guys? Former President Trump seems to be owning the Zorns again, saying there'd be a bloodbath if he's not reelected. Many have commented that the word bloodbath is dangerous. Trump's people say that when he used that word last week, or was it earlier this week, he was talking about a trade imbalance, not actual blood. Eric, you commented briefly about that on our Google Doc this week. What are we talking about here, and what's your reaction to that?
Well, his comment was he was talking about the auto industry, and he was going to impose 100% tariff on Chinese import cars. And then he said, if I'm not reelected, there's going to be a bloodbath. The auto industry happens to be doing pretty well under President Biden, but be that as it may, the use of the term, I mean, when you're someone who talks about shooting people on Fifth Avenue and praising the January 6th rioters who beat up police officers, you don't get the same latitude to use the word bloodbath. And when he said it's going to be a bloodbath, and that's just the start of it or something like that. He added a little bit to that, which indicated to me that he was even going beyond just the very strange use of the term bloodbath to describe economic problems. So I don't think he gets a pass on that. I think he uses words like that as dog whistles, actually not even dog whistles, klaxon horns to his supporters to talk about the possibility of political violence. And if you notice at the State of the Union, when President Biden decried political violence, Republicans didn't applaud. They didn't say like, yeah, political violence, we were against that too. I think there is something in the air here, and I think to sort of say, oh, he's just using bloodbath in its common economic term is nonsense. I think that it's an alarming turn of phrase.
I think if you say I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue, in fact, you are the very sort of person who gets a pass on the word bloodbath. I wasn't alarmed when I heard it, Eric. I thought, I know what he means. It's not a good metaphor, but since when was he good at any kind of speech anyway, except inflammatory? I didn't think he was actually saying shoot people who disagree with us. He was saying that the trade imbalance is bad and he's going to have 100% tariff on cars coming into the United States. Your reaction is the very kind of reaction they were trying to get.
I agree. For what it's worth with that. And it is the quintessential Trump phrase. And it's almost similar to the foreign languages remark that he made, which is another kind of all-timer from him of these are foreign languages. They're so foreign that nobody speaks these languages, which is almost like Yogi Berra-esque. And people rightfully are like, that's crazy and xenophobic. But also then there's coverage of Trump complaining about there being too many foreign languages, which is a visceral feeling felt by some people who are still mad that they have to, you know, press two on a customer service call to speak English, right? And same thing with bloodbath. If people are seeing media coverage of Trump uses bloodbath, they click on the article and they say, oh, he's talking about Joe Biden's, what's going to happen to the economy under Joe Biden. I think that serves him wonderfully.
Maybe there's a tiny bit of wiggle room, but I felt like he kind of hemmed and hawed and got past the car industry such that I felt like when he said bloodbath, that he did kind of mean bloodbath. But on the other hand, he's Donald Trump and he forgot about it 2 seconds later. It's right for us to continue to call these things out and not act like they're normal. But what really bothered me when I saw clips of that rally was when I heard the announcer asking the audience to get up and applaud for the hostages being held from January 6th. The voice of that announcer was really creepy, and then I realized what he was saying, and now that really was out there.
At a time when there are actually hostages still being held in Gaza, he's using the word hostages.
And that is part of the context of this bloodbath remark, which is at the beginning, and Kate's right, at the beginning of this rally, the announcer says, please rise and sing along with the most unfairly treated hostages from the January 6th, the hostages. And those people attacked police officers with batons and flagpoles and sticks and mace and bear spray and things like that. I mean, these people were criminals. They absolutely broke the law. They're not hostages. They're prisoners. And this double talk, this embrace of their violent behavior, this idea that Ashley Babbitt is a martyr. I mean, it is all part of this violent rhetoric. So when you are talking in that context, I don't think you get a pass on using the word bloodbath to describe. You say, if I lose, there's going to be a bloodbath. And they go, oh, I was just referring to the car industry. I don't think that he was. I think he was plausibly giving himself the deniability on that, saying, well, I was just talking about the car industry. But I think we know what he's talking about. He wants, if he loses, he wants his supporters to take to the streets. No matter what the result is, no matter how dubious or close, anything like that, he wants a revolution that puts him in power. I mean, is there any doubt about that? Does anyone doubt that?
I don't doubt that. In fact, I think it'll happen. I think if he loses, there will be violence in the streets. I think there will be blood in the streets, whether he says it or not. But here's his quote. He said, they think that they're going to sell those cars into the United States with no tax at the border. Let me tell you something to China. If you're listening, President Xi, and you and I are friends, but he understands the way I deal, those big monster car manufacturing plants that you're building in Mexico right now, and you think you're going to get that, you're going to not hire Americans, and you're going to sell the cars to us? No. We're going to put 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those guys if I get elected. Now, if I don't get elected, It's going to be a bloodbath for the whole. That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it. But they're not going to sell those cars. They're building massive factories.
What does he think? Right now, there are already auto manufacturers in Mexico.
Eric,
cars are coming into the United States.
Eric, are you trying to parse the logic, wisdom, or truth of what he said? That's old school.
I know it's futile, but if your entire campaign against Joe Biden is going to be basically rooted in inflation, and you're going to throw 100% tariffs on cars coming in from Mexico, which includes cars manufactured by American auto manufacturers,
yep.
Prices are going to go through the roof. And all kinds of associated costs going when you have cars costing that much, all kinds of inflation is going to result, which is the thing about these slapping these really high tariffs on goods. So, but of course, no one's going to fact check him. No one's going to, I mean, his people like to hear things like that.
Too complicated because the tariff is paid by the importer and the importer passes it along to the consumer. So if we put tariffs on cars coming in from China, if you're going to buy that car, it's not China that's paying the tariff. It's you, the consumer.
I hate to say it, but I'm far more worried about the fact that right now it looks like Trump will win. There's your bloodbath.
So what, Kate? I agree with you in that.
I don't want him to win. I'm just saying I'm far more worried. The polls are showing that he will win. So I'm far more worried about that right now. I think we need to focus maybe more on that.
There have been some recent polls in swing states like Nevada and Arizona more favorable to Joe Biden post State of the Union. Maybe hope is not lost, and maybe Biden, who has been the underdog and has been told he's not going to win all of his campaign life, maybe he's got one more in him, because right now, it's some of these people, they may look and say, okay, one's trying to be a dictator and the other's not. So it may just come down to that. That ultimately,
I think, optimistic soul.
The election isn't tomorrow,
Kate.
I'm
not optimistic at all. But I'm just saying there might be a chance.
So March, April, May, June, right. July, August, September, October, November, that's 8 months away. To your concern, which is shared by me, maybe it's too soon to give up hope.
As I recall, Nate Silver pointed out that any bump from State of the Union speech does not last very long.
I think if the election were today, Biden would win, and that there's still a lot of time until the fall. So Trump's goal right now is to put himself in the media every single day, and he's actually doing a pretty good job of that.
Yeah, thanks to Eric Zorn.
Trial coverage will help with that.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not worried.
You can do a reality show.
I'm getting less worried. I'm getting more hopeful. Yeah, less worried.
Are the two of you being encouraged that way? Although maybe you aren't encouraged per se, Austin. Maybe you're just reading what you believe are the facts on the ground. But is it the trials and impending pending trials that give you some hope that maybe this will all weigh on the Trump campaign? Austin,
I think the trials can be good for Trump for the reasons that I just said. And I mean, yeah, he should do...
Even convictions, Austin? Even convictions would
convictions be... not good, but I don't think that's going to happen. And getting off could be very good because that completes sort of the martyrdom full circle narrative, right? Yeah. So it's very risky to be bringing these charges.
I think what hurts Trump, probably hard to believe, but I think the more that he says stuff like this, that's a gift to the Biden campaign. The bloodbath comment, him saying he'll be a dictator on day one, like these are things that independent voters and voters that act like they are on the fence, they could go for either one. That's what they're going to look at.
One last thing, Eric, maybe you'd comment on this, and that is maybe there aren't that many undecided voters. Even Brandon kind of threw up his hands when he said that, like, what is that anymore? I don't think that it's somebody's going to be persuaded to go from one side to the other, but maybe the totality of the legal problems for the former president will just keep some Republicans from voting for him. Maybe it just suppresses the Republican voter turnout. They're not going to vote for Biden, but they're not going to vote for Trump. What do you think of that, Eric?
Well, I think you're right. Or they might vote for Robert Kennedy Jr. or Marianne Williamson, whoever else ends up on the ballot. I don't know. Or Cornel West. They may end up voting for someone else. But I think you're absolutely right that this is an election that's going to be about whether your voters are motivated and are really to turn out to the polls, because I don't think the actual number of people who are going to tell pollsters one way or the other is going to change all that much. But it's whether you get off your ass on election day and get to the polls because you really want your candidate to win. And that's where I think Biden will end up having the advantage. I hope that he will, but there will be too many people, too many voters for Trump to who think to themselves, we don't want the chaos that Trump brings. We don't want the autocratic tendencies that Trump brings. We don't want the restrictions on freedom of choice, reproductive choice that Trump brings. And we're going to come out and vote, even though we're not wild about his policies on Gaza and we're not wild about how he's handled the border. We still think that this is much preferable to Trump, and that'll get them out. That's my guess right now. And I would agree that I think if the election were held today, or if the election were held when the election's held in November, I think Biden's going to win still. But it's gut feeling, that's all.
You know what you made me think of just now, though? Say it with me. Vice President Aaron Rodgers. Huh? Huh? Vice President Aaron Rodgers, RFK's possible running mate. Aaron Rodgers, your quarterback for the New York Jets, the much despised former Green Bay Packers quarterback, VP USA. How awesome would that be, right?
Hey, guys, I have to pop off.
We're all done.
For another call.
We're all done. Good to see you, Brandon.
Good to see you too, guys. Great discussion. Austin, I still love you.
I love you too.
I'll see you guys.
All right.
Bye-bye.
And Austin, we love you. And we love you, Kate. And we love you, Eric.
And we love you, John.
We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. And we'll drop another pod on you next week.
Really fun. Thanks a lot, guys.
Okay. Peace.
Talk to y'all. I'll see you.
See you, Kate.
Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.